again. For those that are taking the exam next week, let me just kind of help you out and know how to study for the exam. There won't be essay questions. Okay. So think of it conceptually. You know, don't worry about memorizing passages or anything of that nature, because as you look at the exam, it will tell you to open your Bible and to close your notes. So look over your notes well. Kind of be able to read through it and explain certain passages, certain concepts in a complete way. There aren't that many questions, but it should take you an hour to complete the exam, okay? So I always tell my students, just impress me. You know, share with me what you have learned in the class up to this point. Okay? Don't worry about regurgitating everything that I say, but what my interest is that you internalize the word, you understand this, and you're able to explain it to me. Just like I'm looking at the question and you're helping me to understand the answer to the question. Okay? Any questions on that? Okay. Well, I've already addressed with them that at this point there's no memorization on the test, and it will be completed later on. We are in Colossians chapter 3, so we want to move through some material. And chapter 3 is really dealing with now our duty as Christians. Jesus having preeminence. He is the one that's important. He's the answer to the problems. And we've kind of looked at that doctrinally, who Jesus is. We've looked at the dangers of the false teachers at that time, different philosophies that were being expressed. Now we're looking at the duty side of it, the outcome of Jesus being first in our lives, that we live for Him. And He started out with the idea that we were baptized into Jesus. It was a spiritual resurrection. Therefore, we seek things that are above, spiritual things, because we want to grow spiritually. To grow spiritually isn't relying on mysticism or Gnosticism or any tenets associated with that. It's really a spiritual growth that, as He will say here, we put off certain things in verse 5, put to death the members that are on earth, and fornication and things of that nature. And then if you notice in verse 8, but now you must put off, the same idea, put off some things. Anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth, okay? But in verse 10, he changes that now to put things off. Now, if you think about it just for a moment, what the Gnostics, if you'll just allow me just to summarize all of that stuff, okay, in Gnosticism, they were dealing with just external things. Don't touch, don't taste, don't do this, don't do that, okay? Even to the point of asceticism, okay, just beat yourself to a pulp, if you will, and that'll take care of the sin problem. Now, it doesn't take care of anything except creates more problems. But what Paul is going to deal with is more internal that affects the external. Whenever you want anyone to change a behavior, the best place to begin is where?
Inside.
The thinking. Because if you can change a person's thinking, you will change that person's behavior or actions. And just think about that sometime from the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus was dealing with our thinking. He was dealing, changing our attitudes. Out of that, the rest of it's easy. Sadly, sometimes folks just focus on changing actions, and they don't change the thinking mind. For long, he's right back the way it was. So what he's going to deal with, okay, we've got to stop some of this stuff, you know, all this bad stuff. And the way to do that is, in verse 10, to put on the new man. Remember we talked about that. Who is renewed in knowledge. That's internal, right? According to the image, that's conforming to the image of Jesus from the inside out. See, all these other things are going to stop, fornication, everything like that, when we are conformed to the image of Jesus, because Jesus didn't do those things. That would be contrary to his nature. And it doesn't matter in verse 11 who you are, where you came from, because Jesus is all and in all. Verse 12. Therefore, as the elect of God, what does it mean to be elect of God?
Chosen.
The chosen, exactly. From the very beginning, we are what God had in mind, and that is the church. And we are a part of that. Holy. That's this idea now being separate apart from sin, right? And that's what the Gnostics were saying. That's kind of our goal. But you have to have this superior knowledge come to us, have this insight, got to do these things. No. In fact, as the elect of God, already chosen, already holy, and beloved by God. Now, here's this idea again, right? Put on. First he said, put on the new man. Now, put on tender mercies. What does that mean, tender mercies? The idea of being compassionate. What does the Bible say about Jesus? He was moved with compassion, right? And the idea, and I think some translations have is bowels of mercy or something like that.
Yeah.
And the thought is, back at that time, not understanding the physiology of individuals or whatever, but emotions sometimes are kind of in the belly area, right? You get nervous and your belly kind of gets jittery and all like that. It's really the heart and all like that, and anxiety. But they felt like, okay, all that stuff's kind of within us, so it must be something around the bowel area or whatever. Well, it really wasn't it, of course. But it's that deep seated level of compassion, okay, that comes from within. It's easy to do compassionate things just externally, okay, I'll help you here, but not really care about it and just doing it. But he's saying, no, this comes from within. Isn't that what we find with Jesus? Moved with compassion. It touched his heart. That's what he's talking about. Kindness. Doing kind deeds for people. Humility. Not thinking highly of ourselves than we are. Meekness. That's power under control. Spiritually speaking, it's under God's control. We're not trying to create weak people. I teach people to be assertive. We can stand up for ourselves, but we do it in a respectful way. It's in a controlled way. It's when people are out of control that we have problems. And long-suffering. Suffering long with folks. So sometimes we have to do that, don't we? Mm-hmm. We've all been there. Bearing with one another. What's the idea of bearing with one another?
Being tolerant.
Okay, being tolerant one another. It's almost there, kind of holding one another up. I want you to get there. It's taking some time. I'll be patient enough to help you to get where you need to be. With one another and forgiving one another. Now let me ask you, who modeled all of that perfectly for us?
Jesus.
Now, notice the connection to put on the new man, that's Jesus, and now this is what you're to put on, being Christ-like. This makes a wonderful lesson, okay? Because the first tells us what to do, and this really gives us the pattern for that. Because if we emulate these things in our lives, we're going to be Christ-like folks. He was very forgiving. Even as Christ forgave you, you also must do. And that is, if anyone has a complaint against another, you bottle it up or talk to somebody else about it. No, we go to that person we deal with. Now, that's how Jesus did. You ever find Jesus having, a complaint, a problem with one of the disciples? Yeah, there were times that he did. And he went to him, right? Like Simon Peter, It's like, let's build a bunch of tabernacles here, okay? Wait a minute, you don't get it. He just confronted him on the matter in a respectful, loving way, but it wasn't running around telling everybody else. Okay. So we must do. And then verse 14, and above all these things, there's our word again. Put on. Love. Agape. Sacrificial love, which is the bond of perfection. We could say, we could kind of bring it into our vernacular as kind of the band or the belt, that which kind of holds it all together. Okay, what holds it all together? It's love, isn't it? The kind of love that Jesus had. Now, would we not use love to describe Jesus? Yeah, instead of God, God is love, we'd say the same thing about Jesus. Jesus was and is love. And when we have these attributes about us, kindness and all that, it will be love that will hold that all together, that gives it meaning. Now, I think the contrast is here, even thinking about the Pharisees, but kind of the context here of all these other so-called religious leaders, the Gnostics, I doubt that they were motivated by love. Because as Jesus addressed the Pharisees, just for show, they just want folks to say, they're your leaders, you know. But for those that are true Christians, those who are the chosen, no, it's motivation. It's that motivation that comes from love that moves us to make those positive differences in other people's lives. Whether anybody knows us or not. You know, it's kind of been my philosophy. I just try to hide behind the cross. But at the same time, I've got to be out here on the other side making a difference in people's lives. Whether I get the credit for it or not, I don't care. As long as people's lives are better in some way or another. Okay. And so it is with those that Paul is addressing here. Any questions, comments?
Love's the foundation. It really is. You know, 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter.
Mm-hmm.
The last word in that chapter is love.
It is.
That's the foundation.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and being, you know, sounding loud, sounding bright, all like that, doing these things to be seen by folks. Yeah, people may be helped by that, but not to the degree if it's done out of love. Excellent point. Yeah. Other thoughts, questions? Okay. Now, notice what he does now with all of that. He says, above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. Now, how do we define perfection?
Maturity.
Pardon me?
Maturity.
That's how we ought to define it. Yeah. But often, how is it defined?
Sometimes it's defined flawless.
Flawless, isn't it? Usually in people's minds, and I think a lot of times even in church folks' minds, when they hear this idea of perfection, it is, okay, got to be flawless, perfect, in the sense of, don't make any mistakes or anything. Got to work to that. Okay. And while we want to set our goal as being Christ-like, and that is not minimizing the severity of sin, not trying to deny anything, we want to live as closely as we can to Jesus' standard of Christianity. The idea of imperfection is maturity. Now, I can be mature, but I can't be perfect as some folks define perfect. Just like, often describe it this way. You know, when we, and we'll go on to read more about this, in a Christian home, husbands and wives want to be faithful to one another. They cannot be perfect for one another. Okay? But I can be faithful. That's ultimately what we're talking about here, is to be faithful, as God defines faithful. It's to be mature. It isn't this thing of being flawless. It isn't this thing of me meriting some level of perfection before God. Okay? And I think sometimes Christians have that idea, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And it creates one miserable Christian existence, if you will. Because it is beating ourselves up all the time, because we're not perfect. Rather than not lowering our standards, but understanding I'm not going to be perfect like Jesus. I'm slapped in the face all the time in Romans 3:23, right? But I can, 1 John 1 and verse 7, walk in the light. I can live the Christian life faithfully before God. And His blood's going to continue to wash my sins away. Well, I can take a deep breath and, oh man, I'm glad it's that way. And I can enjoy the Christian life without it making me miserable. Does that make sense? And that's not minimizing sin or playing games with God. It's just where the rubber meets the road. I am a human being. And like Peter, sometimes I stick my foot in my mouth. Okay.
Did the Gnostics, did they recognize sin? Or did they were they above sin?
They recognized sin, but they believed in this enlightenment, this greatest level of understanding, whatever in the world that is, I have no idea. Then they would reach a point of almost, if not altogether, being sinlessly perfect. Because again, what was really sinful but the flesh.
Right.
So we deprive ourselves, we don't do that. In some religions, kind of like with monks and whatever, you know, asceticism still practiced. They still beat themselves and there are folks with chunks of flesh out of their bodies trying to reach that point, and they feel that they have reached that, therefore they keep depriving themselves to maintain that position. Man, isn't that miserable? But if my perfection, my maturity, my faithfulness is found in Jesus, then I'm going to live the best Christian life that I can. Now, I'm going to play games with God, but I'm going to rely on His grace rather than my perfection. And that's not grace only. It is grace through faith. Yes?
Was that idea that the flesh was sinful, did that come from the Eastern religions, or was there kind of a misunderstanding on the term flesh as used by, you know, Paul and others in the writings? Because we use the word term flesh, I mean, mm-hmm. like the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much the physical existence, but it's the physical pull on man, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Did it come from a misunderstanding like that, or was it more from the Eastern thought?
Well, I'm thinking it was probably a combination of the Eastern thought, but also Hellenism. And I say that because it goes back to the time that they were in Persia, to when a decree was signed, it could not be changed. Therefore, it was absolute. So this concept of absolutism, this idea of it's going to be this way and there is no room for variation. That bleeding over into, first of all, the law of Moses. And I think that's where a lot of this legalism came from, a blending of the Persian law system, spilling over into the law of Moses. And then we have Hellenism, Greek philosophy in that sense of these philosophers and their way of thinking. They could reach some pinnacle point of perfection and all that blending together. I think a mixture of all of that led to this. Is that helpful?
Yeah. So I guess sometimes I don't get have a good grasp on what entirely the Bible means by flesh, because it's not. Fleshly is obviously are negative things, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if all sins are something that you do with the physical body, you know. I mean,
no, pride, I don't think.
You know, you see what I'm saying? Like, pride could be a work of the flesh, but what does your physical body have to do with that? You know?
Right. I think the works of the flesh are usually, as he says, these are manifest, usually things that are seen, which are motivated, again, out of the thinking. And as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he, because it will manifest itself in some form. Okay. And that comes out of then the nature of man. Now, my take on the nature of man may be a little bit different. I don't think that far. But again, I think as Paul is using this idea of nature in Romans chapter 1, I believe it is, and other places, these are things that are learned. Okay. Whether it be culturally learned or misunderstanding of certain things and learned that way. But I think as these things are learned, that becomes that person's nature, and out of that person's nature are certain behaviors that are inappropriate. Yes.
Kind of like in Ephesians when he says you were by nature the children of wrath.
Thanks,
Nathan. I mean, they weren't born sinners or born children of wrath. They learned it through custom or habit.
Yeah, right. But you would almost listen to some folks and it is as though, if not born that way, it is such an acquired nature that there's nothing now I can do about it. Now, I don't think so at all. We can adjust that. So it's not nature in the sense of, you know, biologically that way. It's something that's acquired.
I was thinking about something you talked about here about the Gnostics and they're moving towards sinless perfection, but mm-hmm. as Christians, we really should have that as our objective.
Yeah.
And I would think, you know, that someone is a mature Christian, they're not going around sinning all the time. That's mm-hmm. I mean, and so they are moving, not that that's ever going to occur, but that mm-hmm. should be idealistically the objective of Christians.
Right, right. And that I want us to understand, and to me, that's being Christ-like. That becomes the goal. But what I don't want to do is to be miserable as though I have to reach that. Yeah, as some.
There always going to be a gap.
Yeah, right. And that's the part I understand. I don't minimize it. I'm not complacent with it. But I understand that's a part of this picture. And that's why we go back to, you know, Genesis 3:15, where he starts revealing this plan for us, which is in itself saying, you can't do it by yourself. You need my son in that sense.
Because something I hear from the pulpit even that bothers me sometimes is, you know, people say, you know, we're all sinners. Well, that's really not true. And that kind of bothers me because we're, you know, what we talk about a lot when the last Gospels or the Epistles of John, Tom taught. Mm-hmm. But that's not our practice. And when we say that tends to lead you to think that way.
It is.
Yeah.
What we do is we sin. But if we're sinners, what do we do with this being saints?
Right.
Okay. So there is a difference there. Yeah.
I still find it a hard balance to keep in your mind, practically speaking, you know, because you can always do better than you're doing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. You either take the tendency, of taking God's grace. You know, it's very easy to say, well, that's an excuse. But at the same time, it's not believing in it enough.
Yeah.
And being too hard on yourself.
Right. And that
is a hard balance to keep.
It is. And that, I think, is a part of the spiritual growth process, okay, that he's talking about, is trying to reach that point where we don't take advantage of this, but we, in a biblical way, rely on this, appreciate it, and seeing that is a part of my onward growth.
You know, being the type of person that Paul was, you know, he buffeted his body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he tried to keep it under control.
Yeah.
You know, it was hard for even him to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then other times he's content. Not just in where he is, but content in this process of growth. Okay. And I think that's a part I believe that we often struggle with, is we're often point action. That I want it, when I can get there. Rather than seeing the Christian life as a process, a journey. And we don't know at what point our journey here of spiritual growth will end, and maybe that's why God doesn't tell us, because we shouldn't concern ourselves with that, but to concern ourselves with, this is our journey. And what I often say is, here's the goal, right? And the goal would be
heaven.
That's the goal. But think about life here for us. So much right now is our journey there. So I always tell folks, hey, let's enjoy the journey. Yeah.
Like I think C.S. Lewis said, if you aim at earth, you'll get nothing. If you aim at heaven, you'll get both earth and heaven.
That's it. And that's what I teach. Hey, we can have the best of both worlds. Here, enjoy the journey. We keep on striving to be more like Jesus every day because we enjoy that. That's fun. And when it's all said and done, man, it only gets better. But sometimes, only thing folks can see is the goal. And this is, oh man, I've been missing so much. Because I think a part of life here is the abundant living. Yeah.
Paul said it best when he said, I've learned to be content in whatever state I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever situation he was in, he learned to be content.
Yeah, right. So when we're talking about perfection, we're talking about maturity. We're talking about being more like Jesus and enjoying that. His commandments are not burdensome because we understand the purpose for that. It gives us structure. It helps us, it gives us the material, if you will, that we need to be like Jesus. One other quick thing, and I'll get back to this. See, when we look at the law of Moses from Jesus' perspective, we see how wonderful and how beautiful the law was. Because Jesus was the fulfillment of it. He lived it perfectly. What kind of man did it produce? It produced the Son of God, didn't it? So how could that which produced the Son of God be so bad? I don't know. Something to think about. And not trying to say now it's into the Christian distance. That's not what I'm saying. Because it's out of Jesus now we have a new covenant. Okay.
I guess I would usually think of it as Christ produced the law. He was before it.
He gave it. And it came out of his nature.
Yeah.
And he was. But he lived it completely, fully. You think about Paul and the other Pharisees, and you kind of, well, man, it really produced some bad fucks. You know, how they viewed it, that produced the bad fucks. So, he talks about which is this bond, this band of maturity. Then he says, and let the peace of God rule. Now, the peace is, from a Jewish perspective, it was the absence of strife, and the presence of harmony. And we leave out the last part. Two children are fighting out on the school ground, and we say, now you shake hands and stop that right now. And we look at it, and they're not fighting. Well, they have peace. No, they're just shaking hands and playing together. But from a Jewish mindset, peace was the absence of strife, and something is now present, and that is present, that is harmony. Ultimately with God. We're no longer fighting with God, but we have harmony with God. So let the peace of God rule, or really the idea is to umpire. We've got baseball going on right now. Umpire, right? Let this peace, umpire, rule in your hearts. Notice he's going to the heart again. To which also you're called in one body. The church, okay? Now remember early on I kind of gave you a model that from Colossians it starts out with Jesus and it kind of works into the church. And then we get into Ephesians and it starts out with the church and elevating it to Christian lives. Okay? This is how he's blending all this together. Okay? Being like Jesus, conformed to his image, and because you were called in one body. And be thankful. Appreciate that. Aren't we so appreciative of the church and what it means to us? So in verse 15, and let the peace of God rule. In verse 16, and let. the Word of Christ dwell. Okay. He's basically sharing with us things about Christ that are really to control our lives. It's not to be everybody else and what they think, but it is, first of all, let the peace of God rule, and let the Word of Christ dwell. When he talks about to dwell, he's really saying let it dwell and let it keep on dwelling. Let it just stay there. Live there forever. And it says, in you, it's really in all of you. Okay, that's kind of in this congregational way. Let it dwell in your heart richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. And we often use this, and rightly so. It's a good passage to say we don't use, you know, mechanical instruments of music in worship. Rightly so. But I think if that's all we see, we can really miss so much. Because he wasn't attacking that at that time. So that wasn't the problem. But I think what he is saying here is, when we are conformed to Jesus' image and we are like him, and we appreciate things that were important to him, seeking those things that are above, and God's peace is ruling in our lives. There's that absence of strife. There's tranquility. There is peace in our lives. And Christ's Word, it's dwelling in our lives. It's, you know, changing the way that we think and our attitudes and the way that we live. Out of that existence, from that person's heart, there's going to be a song, a melody in the heart. And we're going to share that with one another. That's what Christ has done for us. That's what it means to be a person after Christ's own image. Jesus have a song in his heart? I think he did. Did he have problems? Yeah, life was difficult for him. But if anyone ever had peace and true joy, it was Jesus. And he could just say, hey, I'm going to walk in the mountain for a moment. And he would go and he would pray. Okay. That's that peace we really want in our lives. And when we are conformed to his image, we'll want to sing this song to one another. We'll want to teach one another what God has done for us. Does that make sense? A little bit more meaningful than just grabbing the passage and saying, okay, this is why we don't use mechanical instruments. Not minimizing that, but saying there's more to the passage than that. Verse 17, and whatever you do in word or deed, what we teach, what we practice, how we live, do all in the name of the Lord. Now, what does that phrase mean?
By his authority.
That's what it's talking about. Do it by his authority. Not the Gnostics' authority, not my authority, or anyone. No. By Christ's authority. Giving thanks to God the Father through him. Going back to this idea of being thankful, being grateful. That comes from the heart. It's not something you just do, you know. You get something like around Christmas time, and then I wonder where they got this gift from. But thank you for it. I appreciate it. Well, we probably didn't mean that at all, right? Maybe a little bit, but, you know, we really struggle with it. But this comes from the heart. Now, out of those changes that really take place in a Christian's life, it changes our relationships with one another. You know, Christianity is pervasive throughout life, every area of life. You don't, you know, compartmentalize your life and, okay, here's this life and that part of my life and that part. I know we do that, but that's all a part of now the Christian life, such as the relationship between husband and wife. Wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. That is to help your husband to live up to this Christ-like image. To help your husband to do the will of God. It's present imperative. So when it says to submit, it's not, I'm suggesting something here. Imperative is what? I command it. I expect this to be done. Okay. To submit means what? I'm trying to struggle with that now, though, isn't it?
Conform to.
Yeah, to
give over the will to the will of another.
Exactly. To submit to another one. Yeah. Doesn't mean she's inferior or anything of that nature. Nor is this to be taken out of context and say, well, women can't be in politics, can't be in, you know, some supervisor's role. No, it's talking about in the home. And when it says that the wife is to submit to her own husband, doesn't mean she's going to submit to every man that says, you know, you do this or you do that. And the other side of the coin is, verse 19, husbands love. And that is to love now, and you keep on loving your wife. And do not, and it's interesting as we look at this, he's saying, stop being. So there may have been some of this going on, okay? Love your wives and do not be bitter, irritable toward them. Stop being irritable toward them. How might they have been irritable toward their wives?
You didn't cook the food right.
Okay, could have been that, couldn't it? Maybe there is a part of out of Judaism, okay, of the wife almost being subservient to the husband, not equal to him. Then it talks about the parent-child relationship. Children, he says to obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Now, in Ephesians, when we get there, it reads just a little bit different, so as we compare them, it's not in the children are to obey the parents in all things, because today's time we've got parents telling children. It's all recently in Target, right? Target being targeted by parents and the children, robbing them. You know, the parents sending the children in to steal from Target to bring it out and they put it on eBay and sell it. Okay. But it is that which is in harmony with God's will. You know, parents obey your, or children obey your parents in the Lord. For this is right. In the Lord, again, is this idea according to the Lord's authority. So it isn't a blanket statement here is all I'm saying. When it says in verse 21, fathers, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged. The idea here to provoke is to irritate, to nag, to hurt their self-respect. Sometimes parents do that, don't they? You ever been somewhere like Walmart or something, and some parents say, you stupid kid, you do this, y'all. That's what he's saying don't do. It provokes them to wrath. Okay. Because they can become discouraged. The idea of discouraged is they just give up. This is all it is. I don't care. Do we have a problem with young people today? Yeah. Guess what we focus on? Them. Guess who we should focus on?
Parents.
There you go. We're not going to correct the problem by, you know, getting onto the kids. Something has to be done. I just realize that. But they've already been provoked. They've already given up. They're already doing what they want. And by putting more pressure on them isn't going to help it. It's when we get back into the home and the home structured as Paul's talking about, then we're going to make a difference. But it's interesting, and this is just a side, with some of the social systems that are in place and established, they won't let you do that. You can't get in the home, you can't address it with the parent. You just have to focus with the kids. And it's a losing battle. Then he talks about holiness in the work life, okay? Servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service, notice how he gets to the heart of the matter again, as men pleasers, but in sincerity of heart, fearing God. Just as you continue to read your Bibles, notice how God, through the Holy Spirit, through these writers, always goes to the heart of the matter. It's not just, you know, stop doing this. No, it's going to be a matter of change your heart to stop doing that. Okay, that's what makes the difference. And whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men. Don't you get tired of people just doing the minimum? Yeah, mediocrity. I mean, just get kind of tired of that all the time. Knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward, literally the full reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ. When we work for our employers, it should be as to the Lord. Like, you know, it's like, I'm working for Jesus. And ultimately, yeah, I get this paycheck, but someday, man, it's out of this world. I'm going to get heaven itself. But he who does wrong will repay for what is wrong, which he has done, and there is no partiality, no partiality with God. Now, let me ask you this. Who is with Paul at this time that this section here would certainly be applicable to?
Onesimus.
All right, Onesimus, right? And this epistle is going to end up in whose hand? Philemon, right? Okay. What a beautiful way to address it. And then he's just going to add another letter with it, right? So he's already established the structure of their relationship, and then with this other letter, it's just the icing on the cake. So he's already started to address the master-servant relationship. Okay. Any questions on chapter 3? Yes.
Do you think that, I've always usually grouped verse 17 more of a comment on what he said previously in verse 16. Do you think that perhaps be an introductory statement to the authority in these ways that we see verses 18 even through chapter 4 and verse 1?
Mm-hmm. Seems to, yeah. I don't know that we would have to just leave it with the previous 16 verses. It may be right in the middle of just a link to all of this. Because you're right. Because here he's talking about establishing this authority. And he uses these words, imperatives, to command, I command you. Even when he gets down here to the servant, obey. You know, I got some authority there, right?
Because I was thinking about the similarity between that and the Ephesians 5. You know,
mm-hmm.
Submitting one to another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that's mutual submission, but in these ways, you know.
I do too.
The way that he's about to spell out, you know, it's kind of an introductory remark.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I don't think it's a blanket mutual submission. So that doesn't seem to work out with the rest of the context. Yeah.
I wonder why also in the, like verse 20 there where it says, you know, children, obey your parents as in the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
But over here in verse 22, it talks about the bondservants obey your masters in all things. It doesn't specify, you know, as long as it's right or as long as it's good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I don't know about them, but that day, you know, you have a lot of your employers that may ask you to do things that's not kosher. You know.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And that would be where other passages would apply as well, and that's looking at the whole picture that we must. Submit to God rather than men. And one other thing to keep in mind that we will look at when we get to Ephesians, the church at Colossae, I believe, would have gotten the letter from that was written to, if you will, the Ephesians. Ephesians would have gotten this. So they're getting the whole story, all those other passages as well. Okay. Now, going into chapter 4, he says, "Masters, give your servants what is just and fair, knowing that you also have a master in heaven." And again, Philemon would be getting this and reading this, which would also, you know, help him to understand what Paul is requesting. He's going to, in Philemon, more in a personal way, request it. But he kind of puts a little bit in there. "But I'm an apostle, and I could, you know, really order this to be done. I'd rather just you do it because it's right." This is he's saying because it's right. Yeah.
It's interesting that he puts kind of a check on everybody that has the authority here.
Mm-hmm. You know,
I mean, the husband has authority over the wife, but he's also, you know, supposed to love his wife. They have authority over the child, but they're not supposed to revoke from wrath. And the masters have the authority over the servants, but they're supposed to treat them. So, wherever God gives authority, you know, it seems like man usually has a problem when he has some authority
and
he's using it.
Mm-hmm.
He always puts that check in there on each of these groups that have authority over another.
Yeah, he does. And I think all that is coming out of being conformed to the image of Jesus. Just imagine how much authority Jesus had and never abused it. He is the master. We are the slaves. He doesn't abuse us, doesn't take advantage of us. And just certain things that are required by virtue of that relationship. He is the husband of the church being the bride. So there is the same type of relationship, but he doesn't abuse the church. He loves it, cares for it. So I think a lot of this is still coming out of being conformed to that image and living up to that. This is just how we treat one another. We are his children. He doesn't provoke us to anger, wrath. He doesn't, you know, irritate us. Yeah, when we love it, it's just a wonderful, you know, healthy relationship. It's not dysfunctional. So he says in verse 2, "Continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant." The idea is being alert in it with all thanksgiving, with gratitude. "Meanwhile, praying also for us, that God would open to us a door for the word." Okay, let's begin working on this. A door for the word, which means what? Yeah, just kind of a door of opportunity. So I can make known the gospel. "To speak the mystery of Christ." And part of that was that Christ dwell in your hearts richly. And that would be in the Gentiles, right? "Speak the mystery for which I am also in chains." And that has to do with his house arrest, right? That's where he is. Now, Paul is in prison, house arrest, but he still wants those folks to pray for him, that even in that confinement, that God would give him a door of opportunity to speak a good word, right? Does that happen? And I'm just kind of searching through some other Bible passages and so forth. Does it happen? Yeah.
Philippians 1, the whole palace had heard.
Exactly. Right. So it works. It helps. And that door was open. Now, so he's talking about a door of opportunity to speak the word of Christ in verse 4, "that I may make it manifest," that is to declare it openly and boldly, "as I ought to speak." That is the proper presentation. Sometimes, I think, especially maybe a little bit more in the past, but it was a matter of, okay, let me tell you what the Bible says, without considering how I ought to share that message with you. And some folks have been turned off by the presentation. Let me illustrate. I mean, you're like a good, well, grilled steak. Do I got? Okay. I mean, this is the best cut of meat. It's been flown in from Australia. I mean, it doesn't get any better than this. And we've got the best chef in the world. He's grilled this. And you like baked potato? Hey, we're going to bake potato with it. But we got some work. This is great. And it comes into the room, but it's on a garbage can lid. You still looking forward to it? Same meat, right? Same meal, but presentation. I think sometimes that door's been open and we've shut it because of our presentation. And what, I let them have it. I told them what God said. Yeah, you may have, but then you've turned them off. So they'll probably never want to hear it again. Because it's no longer palatable. It's distasteful. Am I saying that all preaching is going to be positive? No, that's not what I'm saying. But I think at the same time, we have a responsibility that when we are correcting folks, when we're dealing with a negative preaching, I still have to be respectful and present in a way that folks want to hear that, so it will make the needed corrections in their life. So many times I've been out and folks will say, you know, you're from the Church of Christ? I'll never go there. And usually what I hear is somebody told them they're going to go to hell. And I don't doubt it. I'm just not sure that's palatable.
We have to be tactful.
Yeah, it is. And it's, as it goes on to say, it's being wise. Walk in wisdom toward those who are outside. What does it mean to be outside?
Outside
the church. Outside the church, yeah. Unsaved state. You be wise toward those that are outside, redeeming the time. You buy up the time and you use it wisely, because this may be your only opportunity. Sometimes we hear preachers stepping on toes. Let me share with you a better way of doing that. Touch hearts. Step on toes, you just upset folks. You touch a heart with the same message, and you can change lives. So I think, as he's saying here, is you're going to deal with this stuff out here, okay? What people are saying, I mean, it's irritating, it's wrong, all like that. At the same time, as you are trying to make those changes, use wisdom. Because I have, as I ought, a moral obligation before God to speak the truth in love, Ephesians 4:15, right? Yeah. And if I do that, I'm not going to minimize its truth. I'm not going to, you know, skirt over things. I'm not going to fail to declare the whole counsel of God. I'll share a bit of it, but hopefully in a way that will make a difference in someone's life. Any questions or comments on that?
Do you think that when Paul writes his first letter, that maybe he had in mind what effect he would have in Rome? I mean, there he is, and bound up, you know. And before, I mean, before he had had situations where God actually, in a sense, closed some doors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he wanted to go someplace, and the Spirit suffered him not.
Yeah,
he didn't allow it. And so it. I don't know. It's an interesting thing to me, that the implication that God would actually close a door, but maybe because opening another one would be better effect for what he wants and his will.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I've even seen, I think, in my life, and I can't presume on what God does and doesn't do, but I think there have been times in my life that doors have been closed at that point. And somebody else walked in and probably did a far better job than I could have done. And just maybe because, you know, the connection that they had, maybe, you know, knowing the people in a different way, being accepted, they would accept them where maybe they wouldn't have accepted me. Maybe I would have just muddied the water. Yeah. Because ultimately it's God's plan. He knows the best way to fulfill it. It's just being open and compliant to his will, where he wants us to go. That's fantastic. You don't want me to go there? That's okay. I can live with it. Yeah. Very good point. He talks about verse 7, Tychicus, who is a beloved brother, faithful minister, and a faithful servant in the Lord, will tell you news about me. Okay, and Tychicus is going to be bearer of these letters. At least this one, Ephesians and Philemon. Okay, so he's going to bear them. I am sending him to you for this very purpose, that he may know your circumstances and comfort your heart with, he's going to be traveling with him, Onesimus, a faithful and beloved brother who is one of you. And he was from that area, Colossae. They will make known to you all things that are happening here. Right? Share that information with them. Then Aristarchus, my fellow soldier, greets you with Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, about whom you received instructions. If he comes, welcome him. And what do we know about Mark?
He left him behind.
Yeah, left him behind. Yeah. But now, different, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's growth. That's spiritual growth. Okay. And Jesus, who is called Justice, these are my fellow workers for the kingdom of God who are of the circumcision. Okay, Jewish folks. They have proved to be comfort to me. So not all the Jewish folks were bad, okay? It all sided with the Pharisees. Epaphras, who is one of you, a servant of Christ, greets you, always laboring fervently for you in prayer. Now, we often don't think about laboring fervently in prayer. It's usually when we're out doing things, right? But prayer is very important. Sometimes we hear, well, that's the least I could do for that person. No, sometimes that's the most you can do for that person, is to pray for them. And that's thinking about the efficacy, the power of prayer. It makes a difference in a person's life. And for Paul, that was laboring fervently. That you may stand, wow, there's that word again, perfect, or mature is the idea, and complete. And I think he's talking here about confident. That you are stand mature and confident in all the will of God. How can we stand mature and confident in that?
Through study.
That's exactly it. It goes back to, again, chapter 3 and verse 10, growing in that knowledge, right? Taking on that new image in knowledge. May I have just a couple minutes of your time and I'll finish this up? Okay, thank you. For I bear him witness that he has a great zeal for you, zealous for you, really enthused about helping you, and to those who are in Laodicea and those in higher office. Luke, the beloved physician, and Demas greet you. Now, guess what happens 4 years later with Demas? Yeah, he is forsaken, having loved this present world. Yeah, 2 Timothy 4 and verse 11. He says in verse 15, greet the brethren who are in Laodicea and Nymphas and the church that is in his house. Now, Nymphas, we don't know if that's a male or a female. Only thing we know, the church met in this person's home. Okay, is the Greek just doesn't give us enough to differentiate. Verse 16. Now, when this epistle is read among you, see that it is also read in the church of Laodicea, or the Laodiceans, and that you likewise read the epistle from Laodicea. Now, it could very well be we've lost that epistle. Or it could be he's really talking about the book of Ephesians. Because some of the manuscripts don't have Ephesians. It's more of a general epistle. And those epistles would go to certain places and they would copy it and send a copy to someone else. So it may very well be, it's just my opinion, okay? But it seems to make sense to me. They would have this one, and then this, Colossians would be copied and sent to Ephesians. And it could very well be that the Ephesians was looking at their course, stopped at Laodicea. They got that, they made a copy of it, and they sent it on to the Ephesians.
Yeah. Either way, I mean, doesn't change anything. Because God has what he wants in the Bible. I mean,
right.
There is an epistle written to Corinth before 1 Corinthians.
Yeah.
That God didn't include in the Bible, so he didn't need it. So.
Right. Yeah, and that I don't struggle with, that we don't have it or anything. It could very well be lost. But as you route their course, they're going to be carrying this epistle, also what we know as Ephesians and Philemon. Why not stop off at Laodicea and they read this, and it be one that we know as Ephesians, and then ultimately it's carried on? Could be. Just something to think about. Then verse 17, and say to Archippus, and I believe Archippus is the preacher now, since we don't have Epaphras. Epaphras is now in Rome. It seems as though he's now a prisoner there. He's not there now preaching, but we do have Archippus there. Take heed, this is what you say too, and take heed to the ministry which you have received in the Lord, that you may fulfill it. Live up to that, to God's expectation. This salutation in my own hand, Paul. So if the salutation is in his hand, he may have had what we call amanuensis, someone who wrote it down for him, dictated it. Which wouldn't be anything wrong with that. Still inspired, telling him what to write. Remember my chains, his imprisonment. Grace to you, amen. Let it be. Now, I don't think, as he's saying here, remember my chain in a sympathetic way. It is all, woe is me, remember me. But I really think it goes back to his authority. I am in chains because I am an apostle. I am here for this reason, and I'm sending this, therefore respect it as an epistle from an apostle. Okay. Any closing questions or comments? Okay, we wrap that up there. Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.